Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. It's 2:10 p.m. With me this morning is Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick. Senator Hoffman will be by shortly. He's away on other state business. We've got two bills up this afternoon. First bill, Senate Bill 52 with the Senate Education Committee. The base student allocation. Senate Bill 48 by the governor for the carbon offset. I'd like to welcome Senator Hoffman to the Finance Committee meeting this afternoon. First bill up, Senate Bill 52. The bill has been heard several times, including public testimony. We plan to introduce a new committee substitute, take the amendments, see what's the will of the committee. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 52, Work Order 33, LS03-69, /R, as our working document.
We have objection to that. I'll object. Senator Ken Alper will go ahead and give us a summary of the changes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ken Alper, staff to Senator Olson and the Finance Committee. You have before you the R version of the Senate Bill 52, the BSA bill. You'll note that the first seven plus pages of the bill are unchanged from the previous version. That's all of the language about dashboards and reporting and so forth that was added by the Education Committee. The one substantive change is on page 8, line 7, where the BSA increase itself was increased by $680 from $5,960 to $6,640, and that would be effective this coming July 1st for the fiscal year 2024 budget. There is no second year increase, which was in the previous version of the bill. And that's all of the changes, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to CS? If not, Senator Tobin and Mike Mason, would you mind coming up and giving us your comment on the committee substitute?
Thank you very much to the committee. For the record, my name is Lukey Gail Tobin, Senator for District I.
My name is Mike Mason. I am staff to Senator Lukey Gail Tobin.
Give us your take on what the committee substitute does or says or doesn't do and what you'd like to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the committee here for their work on Senate Bill 52. While the numbers are different, the proposed committee substitute here from Senate Finance meets the policy goal set forth by the Senate Education Committee to significantly increase the base student allocation. This is why I personally, and hopefully the committee, also shares my support of the CS. We are committed to working with the other body and doing everything that we can to ensure the passage of this legislation this year. After 99 days of public testimony, hearings, and meetings, it is very clear to us that the Alaska public education system is struggling, and we need to do something drastic. This bill does just that. If passed and become to law, it will be a permanent increase to the base student allocation that will help every child and young adult who receives a public education here in Alaska. I thank you very much to the committee, and if there's any additional questions, I am here at your disposal.
Do we have any other additional questions by the committee members for the bill sponsor or her aide? If not, do we have amendments? I'll take my objection away. Do we have amendments? Senator Bishop?
Yes, I move amendment number one.
Do we have objection to amendment number one? I'll go ahead and object it for an explanation.
Amendment number one does what we did last year at this table. It raises the residential stipend for residential schools, our boarding schools in rural Alaska. We had it in last year for $4.2 million, and the governor vetoed it down to $2.1 million. That's what amendment number one does, $4.2 million to boarding schools.
Any further questions by members of the committee? Senator Wilson.
Thank you. The maker of the amendment can describe which boarding schools this all applies to in the state of Alaska.
Senator Bishop.
The amendment is, I'll read it, it's off the amendment. The Southeast Region, South Central Region, Nenana, Galena,
Southwest,
Northern Remote, Nome, Kotzebue. It covers them all.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson. I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to the amendment number one? Do we have a comment by the members? Bill sponsored amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lukey Tobin, Senator for District I. We are in support of this amendment. It's a 50% increase to support our operating residential schools, which also have been affected by inflation and years of flat funding.
Okay. Any further objection to amendment number one? If not, amendment number one passes. Good enough. Do we have another urgent amendment?
I move amendment number two.
Amendment number two, Senator Bishop.
Yes.
I'll object for explanation.
And I'd like to have your trustee aide come up and talk about amendment number two.
Mr. Alper, identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your explanation.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Ken Alper for the record. Senator Bishop's amendment number two amends the statute that is the base number for the so-called pupil transportation formula. This is the input that they use in calculating the line in the budget. It's 70-some million dollars today. That covers the cost of the school buses and so forth in the various school districts around the state. For a little history, that the number in the budget right now goes back to fiscal year 2013. There have been a couple of uncodified increases that have changed what they're using. The latest number that the formula is based on is from FY 2016. So what's an amendment number two before you is a rewrite of the list, and you can see it's 3 pages long just because every school district in the state has its own number. But what we did was take the FY16 number as a baseline, calculate the inflation between that and today, and increment by half the amount of the inflation. So again, Mr. Chairman, we're taking half of the accumulated inflation between FY16 and now, adding it to the base number. It's about an 11% increase in what the numbers were, and I would estimate, and clearly the real fiscal note people will estimate better, but there's about $8 million of additional transportation funding in this amendment.
Does the bill sponsor supportive of the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Lukey Tobin, Senator for District I. We are in support. We know that flat funding has significantly eroded our pupil transport dollars, which means school districts are using money from their base student allocations to supplement and offset the unmet need and costs within their pupil transport. I know in Anchorage particularly, the current funding only covers 75% of their pupil transport needs. This will significantly go to helping our schools get kids to the classroom.
Any other members of the committee have questions either for the bill sponsor, the aide for explain the changes, or the sponsor of the amendment? Senator Wilson.
Thank you. And just want to make sure, so what we're talking here is a 50% increase based off of the inflationary rate. So this is a 50% inflationary rate increase?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, the accumulated inflation for those years was about 22%. So half of that, or about 11%, is what the actual increase in this amendment is.
Okay. And that's an $8 million per year increased
the pupil amount. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the pupil transportation line item in the operating budget, I don't have it in front of me, but from memory, it's around $72 million. So roughly 11% of that, or $8 million. Yes.
All right. Thank you.
$8 million. Is that just that portion of the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, the cost of this amendment, if the pupil transportation number is, say, $72 million right now, this would bring it up another eight to about $80 million. And I look to Senator Stedman to correct me if I'm wrong on the 72 number, but I'm pretty sure that's what the pupil transportation number is in the budget right now.
Okay. Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to say this, even with this amendment, if accepted by the table, you still have districts that will still be on the margins with this number. So this gives us time to look at it going forward in the out years. And with the original spirit of the bill at 680, I mean, we're acknowledging that there is a problem with the busing, and we're just trying to keep as much money in the classroom as possible.
We still have an objection on the table. Ready for the vote?
Senator Wilson.
I'm sorry.
Who at ease? call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. There is an objection to Amendment Number 1. Call the roll, please.
Senator Wilson.
No.
Senator Bishop.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Merrick.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Yes.
Senator Stedman.
Yes.
Okay, with that, the Amendment Number 2 passes. Taking at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting back to order. Senate Bill 52 is still before us. Senator Stedman.
Yes.
You have a motion.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Do we have any questions of the bill as amended? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. I actually have a question for the operating budget co-chair. I'm curious, version R as amended, how that will affect the operating budget in any way, if so.
Senator Stedman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the bill would have to be passed and signed by the governor. This number here would match the operating budget, the 680 BSA increase. But this, in the operating budget, but this would make the BSA increase permanent into the base, the 680. So depending on when and if the bill was in final passage, and I'd have to.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Are you finished?
There would have to be additional language to the budget that if this was signed, that the money in the operating budget would be eliminated so that they wouldn't end up with two appropriations for the same thing. So there would have to be a budget amendment.
It is?
It already is? Okay.
Unless we pulled it out inadvertently, because we moved things in and out. But
you need a double check.
Yeah, we don't want to double dip.
Follow-up, Senator Mary?
Yes, so just for clarification, should Senate Bill 52 be adopted and signed by the governor, then the $680 will be in the formula. And should we not adopt this and just pass the operating budget, it'll be outside of the formula.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any further questions by members of the committee about the bill and how it's been amended? If not, Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Finance Committee substitute Senate Bill 52, Work Order 33, LS03-69 /R, as amended, with attached forthcoming fiscal notes and individual recommendations to the next committee referral.
Without objection, this bill has moved from committee.
At ease.
Finance Committee meeting back to order. Next up is Senate Bill 48, Carbon Offset Program by the Governor. This bill was heard this morning. We plan to finish the presentations from the administration, then take public testimony. Ms. Rena Miller, a special assistant to the Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources, is at the table. Please identify yourself for the record. Go ahead and have your opening comments, and then we'll go to Mr. Joshua Strauss, Senior Vice President from ANU. Ms. Rena.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rena Miller, Special Assistant, Commissioner's Office, Department of Natural Resources. I have no further comments, Mr. Chairman, at this time. If we could turn to Mr. Strauss to continue his presentation.
Mr. Strauss, are you on, sir?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. If it's okay, then I'll just resume where we were at the credit buyers slide, page 7.
If you would, please. Go ahead. Make sure you stop it at the end
of
the slide so we can have questions.
Understood. Will do. So where we had left off, we had talked about how there had been a large uptake in commitments for reducing emissions in the voluntary market, and we had given some examples of buyers, large buyers in the economy that are taking part in this. This list is just a very small list, but it shows the breadth of the folks participating, everything from technology companies to food companies to banks to automotive design, you know, really every sector of the broad economy. And having all those commitments in place, whether they be for 2030 or 2050, it does build a real meaningful market behind or for these credits that we would advise the state of Alaska to be interested in potentially generating. I will pause there, and then we can move into the landowner obligations associated with the project.
Go ahead with your presentation. I see no questions at the table.
Okay. So the next slide, this is jumping a bit, but the section that we're in, just to remind folks, is the forest carbon fundamentals. So I just talked about certain aspects of the market. Now I want to talk about what does it mean for the DNR to actually participate in one of these projects. And what I've laid out here in this very basic table are just the key obligations and requirements under the American Carbon Registry's voluntary program, and that's the program that was recommended in the ANU report. Some key things to think about here, the total commitment period. So if DNR was to enroll some of its land in one of these projects, the commitment for any given project would be 40 years. So 40 years, and during that time period, what you would be committing to is A, and this is sort of the key rule, is maintaining or increasing carbon stock on that landscape for that entire period. So the idea is that if you're going to be increasing carbon sequestration, you have to make sure that you at least maintain, if not increase, the total biomass, the total carbon on that acreage over the life of the project, so over the four-year period. Now, in order to ensure that you are doing that, there are verification and reporting requirements that are involved. And the fundamental ones there are is that, you know, when you start the project, you need to do a detailed forest inventory, and I'll talk a little more about that later. So really being sure you know what's on the ground. And then that needs to be updated on a decadal basis. On a five-year basis, you need to have a verification done where a third-party auditor will come and review the documentations that have been designed in the project development process, review the calculations and the quantification to confirm that, in fact, things that are being stated in terms of emissions reductions claims are justified by the underlying force in the materials. And those verifications will involve an actual on-the-ground audit where third-party bodies who are accredited by the registry and basically the individuals who conduct these audits are experts in the forest carbon space. They'll come around and actually sample a statistically significant selection of the forest carbon plots to confirm that the information in the inventory is actually accurate. And then the last piece here in terms of annual obligations, you do need to report on an annual basis the harvesting that goes on across the property so that can be clearly tracked, and any unintentional loss, you know, which may be, you know, a significant loss from fire, wind damage, pest, something along those lines. And the additional components that you should think about are that in these programs, you're required to have some sort of certification for your forest management, confirming that you are thinking about a broad collection of ecological benefits with your forest and not strictly designing a forest monoculture at the detriment to the rest of the ecology in the area. Generally, from private landowners, that's done via FSC, SFI, or tree farm certification. In the public sector, if you have a state-approved forest management plan, you by nature of having that approval, check that box, so the DNR would automatically satisfy that requirement. And I'll pause there for a second.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Strauss, you piqued my interest, and I didn't think of this in the other committee till just now. You talked about landowner obligations. It should be to increase carbon intake, right? And so my question is to you, so should you write a reopener in your contract in 5 years after you, or 10 years after you've done your verification, and or in 10 years after you've looked at your inventory, and if you have increased your intake of carbon, do you have a reopener on the contract, or is it prorated? Am I off base?
Mr. Strauss.
Yes, through the chair. I think I do understand the question. It is a rolling obligation. So the idea is that as you increase your stocking across that property and it is verified on those five-year bases, and I will add that you can verify more often if you choose. 5 years is the minimum, is the maximum amount of time that can go in between verification events. So if you verify your total carbon sequestration and reduction effect, and then get issued these carbon offset credits for it, at that point, it is a rolling commitment to, at that point, that's your new minimum. You have to maintain that level for the rest of the 40-year period. So it's an ongoing quantification process.
Thank you. But my question is, if I've increased my carbon sequestration from the previous 5 years, shouldn't I be allowed to then renegotiate? Because I'm taking more carbon, I should be getting more money.
Strauss.
Through the chair, on an ongoing basis, you can continue to keep generating credits and continue to keep generating more revenue. So the idea is, if every year that you verify, they can reapprove just exactly how much you've taken outside of how much carbon has been absorbed, and you can get credit for each one of those tons, sell each one of those tons. So you, in effect, are going to be monetizing that throughout the period.
Thank you.
Mr. Strauss, go ahead with your presentation.
Okay, thank you. So I'll move on to the next slide. This tries to highlight some of the very key components to the quality of a forest carbon offset, and this is one of the reasons why in our report we've landed on the ACR program, or the American Carbon Registry program. Some of these were discussed by Ms. Miller. I'll try not to be too duplicative here, but just to rather quickly go through. Additionality is at the crux of any carbon offset project. That's the idea that what you're committing to doing is actually removing carbon from the atmosphere or maintaining carbon in a sink that currently exists, like in a forest, and that in the absence of the project, there you would see actually less carbon being removed from the atmosphere or more being released. So that it's basically saying that you're doing something meaningful. Permanence is a bit of a misnomer, but it's the length of time for which your commitment exists. Now, there are different takes on what an appropriate permanence period is, but in a 40-year commitment in the ACR world, that's something that you know for at least four solid decades that carbon is going to maintain in a sequestered state. Verification and monitoring, as we discussed in the previous slide, in order to have confidence that the credits you're generating are accurate, you need to have a third-party body that's going to go and review the work that was conducted by the landowner, the developer, and put their non-biased stamp of approval on the quantification effort that took place to confirm that all the calculations were done correctly. Then registration serialization. Registration is the registries, as I mentioned, one before the American Carbon Registry, but other popular ones you may have heard of are the VERA Registry in the compliance sector, the California Air Resources Board. These are all nonprofit bodies that maintain the infrastructure through which these credits are developed and sold and retired. So they allow for, once a project is verified, then each individual carbon offset unit can be serialized so that it can be traded and then retired only once. So it's important that there's never double counting on these projects, so someone can only claim the right to the emission reduction a single time. These bodies actually facilitate that entire process, as well as controlling the fundamental underlying infrastructure through which the credits are, which, or methodologies, which explain how you can quantify the carbon. They're actually put in place by the registries, who utilize academics and other organizations with the explicit goal of trying to reduce emissions to help generate these protocols. And then those protocols are what are utilized to do the quantification effort. Leakage, as Ms. Miller had mentioned, is the issue of if you're conducting a project in one area, does that lead to greater loss of emissions in another? One of the key ways that could happen is if a single landowner had two properties, and on one property they decided to reduce harvesting and therefore create carbon offsets, and on another property then just simply increase harvesting over there to make up the difference, that would be against the rules of the protocol. That's sort of what they call activity shifting. Leakage is not permitted under the American Carbon Registry. Other leakage, known as market effects leakage, is what happens when someone who is not connected to the project may increase their harvesting simply because the market is demanding more of the product that the other forest would have been producing, and that leakage is accounted for in the carbon calculation. Reversal is the idea of what happens if credits are lost due to either an intentional act, which would be harvesting of the trees beyond what the commitment would allow, or unintentional acts, which we've mentioned earlier, as fires, wind events, pest infestation, anything that would be considered an act of God. Now, the intentional reversals, that is actually the responsibility of the landowner. So if you were to harvest beyond the amount of credits that you'd claimed, right, if you'd harvest such that your actual stocking on the property dropped below that level for which credits had been awarded, you would have to pay back those credits to the American Carbon Registry in this case. But if it's anything other than an intentional act, so like let's say we have a fire situation, then your buffer pool, which is the next item on this line, or your insurance plan covers you against the vast majority of that loss. So the idea being is that on an ongoing basis, every time credits are issued, approximately 18 to 20% of those credits go into a buffer insurance account. And therefore, if something were to happen on the property, that account covers off against these catastrophic loss. You could think of it sort of like a homeowner's insurance, where you're paying into it on an annual basis. And in most years, you won't have any need to tap into it, and hopefully you never do. But if you do, that the insurance payments that you've been making over that time period cover you against a disproportional loss of what might have happened on the property. So that's really a key piece. Having that buffer is a key piece of the integrity of any of these systems, particularly in a natural ecosystem case. And with that, I'll pause and see if we have any questions.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Mr. Strauss, I've been watching some specials on NOVA about carbon, and specifically, my question is, they were talking about forest fires on this unintentional loss column here that you brought up, fires. It said in that series that a forest that had burned and then the regrowth coming back up through that forest is still capturing 80% of the carbon that the mature forest was capturing. Is that fact or fiction, or can you comment?
Mr. Strauss.
Yes, through the chair. I would say that, I don't want to speak to that specific forest, but in general, if you were to have a very significant fire event, and it's going to vary based on the significance of the event, you can, in fact, damage the seed bed and the undergrowth. So you may have a situation where you're having significantly hampered growth. Now, in a fire-prone environment that is adapted to such a uh, such a type of a fire regime, then you could see quite quick response. The big problem you see, though, is you have to think about the carbon balance. So in the whole, though, you may be seeing growth that might have been rivaling the speed of the – so you had the previous older forest, and it was growing at a certain rate, taking X amount of carbon. You may see a growth rate that could be somewhat similar to that. You know, this new after the burn, a new forest coming up at growing at a similar rate, you still have lost a substantial amount of the carbon that was represented in the existing trees. And that's one of the really important things to account for. And that's where that piece is crucial to think about when you're considering the burnt forest versus the standing one.
So Bishop, just to follow up on that, on your comment there. So is that then what you just described, is that a somehow part of a formula that we should look at, or the DNR should look at, as far as the risk pool and how do they get to that number for the buffer?
Mr. Strauss.
Yes, through the chair. So there's an explicit calculation for coming to your risk number for the various different threats, fire being one of them. And it will take into account the specifics of your forest in the region. The 20% number or the 18% number that we used was the number that was appropriate to be used for the calculation at the time that this study was conducted about a year ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Continue on, Mr. Strauss.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. Mr. Strauss, these last couple categories here, you encouraged us to think about them like an insurance plan if something goes funny. We have an insurance regulator in Alaska, and if you're paying out $100 million in claims from your company every year, we don't let you collect $120 million in premiums year after year after year. So is there somebody who watches? Because ultimately these insurance credits are carbon going into Alaska trees and Alaska soil that Alaska's not getting any money for. Who watches this to make sure that there's a tight relationship between the number of tons of carbon we're pledging to the pool and what actually leaks out?
Mr. Strauss.
So, excuse me. Yes, through the chair. Specifically, when you talk about the amount of credits that are going to be required by these given forests, they do update over time. The program will update based on, you know, changing perceptions of risk, how many credits need to be given to the pool. It actually was just updated within the last year as to, you know, how that calculation is taken into account. But for any specific single forest, if you were to have a really catastrophic event, it wouldn't be that you would necessarily be able to just retake up producing large numbers of credits. If you lose the vast majority of your forest in a massive fire, and then it is supplanted by an unintentional reversal, well, the forest's ability to continue to produce the amount of credits that it would have in the absence of the fire will be far from commensurate with what it once was. So you're inherently not going to be able to just go and continue to produce at that level. You lost so much of your underlying carbon. So it in effect does a little bit of a self-balancing act if you have something that's that significant.
Bob, Senator Bishop. I'm Senator Keel, I mean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I heard somebody recently did update, but is that a rule? And if so, who enforces it?
Mr. Strauss.
Yes, through the chair. So the American Carbon Registry does manage the entire program. They have a programmatic system for calculating your risk. They, meaning the American Carbon Registry, just issued an update to their process for the calculation. So I think system-wide, this is not just a static system. They, on a dynamic basis, can reassess risk for various causes to make sure that the system is well insured, to continue the analogy. Now, what I was saying, though, is on a specific project basis, if your concern is that one project could experience generate a bunch of credits, experience a huge loss event, and then the next year just go on generating huge amounts of credits again, I'm saying that inherently, if you have a massive, massive loss event, there's been such a loss of carbon on that landscape that it will not be able to then turn around the next year and produce the amount of credits that would have been there had the forest been intact.
Senator Keel?
No, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think what I'm hearing is nobody enforces it. We have to trust the smart guys outside. It goes back to Senator Stedman's concern.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, I'd like to, again, this is all new to us, most of us are at the table, but help me again with the American Carbon Registry. Are they the only ones in existence, or can other firms be put together as a registry? How is the registry market formulated and controlled?
Mr. Strauss.
And regulated.
Sure. Yeah, through the chair. So there are two different marketplaces, as we discussed earlier, the compliance and the voluntary. In the compliance realm, generally the Air Resources Board is the ultimate authority out of California. But they utilize the services of the three most well-known nonprofit registries, the Climate Action Reserve, the American Carbon Registry, and VERA, or the Verified Carbon Standard. In the voluntary space, those three bodies each individually operate three separate registries. They all generate carbon offset credits. They all serialize those units. They all have their own protocols and methodologies for analyzing carbon across the landscape in this case, and crediting out how many carbon credits should be attributed to any given project. They are, as I mentioned before, these are nonprofit entities with the sole driving goal of reducing emissions and addressing the climate change issue. And they are predominantly run by folks with significant background in the sciences as well as in academics. And yes, all three of them have competing programs in the sense that they all have different ways to ultimately generate their units. But the reason why, and we've worked in all of them, I would say, and Anew did consider these in our report, the reason why we had chosen to highlight the American Carbon Registry in our particular case was because of we felt that it has the most up-to-date, top-flight view of how carbon credits should be generated in the U.S. context. And I'll pause there.
So there's no regulatory oversight on these, and any, you know, there could be more nonprofits put together to do this. Is that correct at any given time?
That could be correct. What it operates based on is the integrity and the reputation of these various groups, the reputations of the folks involved in them, and the market's appreciation of the various quality from the different registries. So the market in itself is choosing what they believe.
Honorable Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, when you're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars and tying up property for decades, if not generations, I think there needs to be some regulatory oversight at some point along the way.
I totally agree. Thank you very much, Mr. Strauss. Go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Moving on to the next slide, this is just quickly to zoom in on the pilot projects that we examined, a split project in Haines in Southeast Alaska, another one in Tanana, and then a third in Matsu. I want to briefly go into just how we established, you know, these areas and why we were using these as our pilots. This was basically in extensive discussion with the folks from DNR Forestry. These places were selected because of A, we had access to a certain amount of data from them. B, we were really thinking about, you know, where is carbon stocking present across the landscape? And then C and D, both accessibility and marketability. You know, where are there trees of marketable value, and where are there markets that can absorb them? What is the infrastructure around those areas that can lead to the potential for harvesting versus provide an opportunity to manage forests differently? And at the end of the day, after running these projects through the calculations and you know, executing a hypothetical complete, you know, project calculation carry through, it looks like these basic projects, with each of them representing about 100,000 acres roughly, would generate about 10 million offsets over the 40-year lifetime of the projects. And then if you want to think about it specifically from the more near-term, like, fiscal benefit, if we think at today's current pricing, it would be generating over $80 million in revenue for the DNR in just the first 10 years of the project. And in the slide deck that Ms. Miller provided, it shows some of the real more granular details of those calculations. But I wanted to take a second to just highlight that here briefly in the context of all the other pieces that we were talking about. And I will say these should be understood as pilot analyses, right? Like, this is not based on us having verifications done. This is not based around us having, you know, full on-the-ground carbon-based inventories, but it is using some pretty sound data that was provided by the DNR forestry team, and it should directionally give you a very clear view of what these projects are likely to be able to produce.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you. Dealing with District 1, which is Haines Southeast, I see that there's a lot of little speckles on Prince of Wales and some other ones on the, you know, southern side. Does that include any merchantable timber that could be harvested in that area off of State Forest, those little dots?
It's considering timber that should be merchantable at some point during the 40-year project life.
Okay, and then...
So it's not all necessarily merchantable today, but stuff that throughout this expected four decades would be merchantable.
Right. Well, we don't have very much timber down here in Southeast. Most of this is all federal forest. So there's some concerns there. But then with such a little bit of land, private land and state-owned land available in Southeast, why is it a targeted area for this proposal? When we don't know if it's going to prove up or not, why isn't it brought in later when we actually know this isn't going to work?
Senator Strauss,
through the chair, I would say part of the desire here from DNR's point of view when we were brought onto this work was to try and see how things might perform in a variety of different locations. If you were going to, you know, it's not a necessary thing that all these acres would have to be enrolled into a project. It was about trying to examine what the potential was in a given area. And I would say that in that Haines/Southeast Alaska area, the vast majority of the credits are really coming from the Haines portion. That's of any of these different areas to look at, Haines seems to be the most of a, you know, straightforward slam dunk of them all. But that doesn't mean that there isn't additional value that's gleaned from the Southeast parcels.
Senator Stedman?
No, I'm just concerned that, you know, there's not a lot of economic opportunity in Southeast, and to start trying to restrict what little bit of property we have is of concern. I would agree that the Haines area is a little different than the Southern Southeast. Also, the most marketable timber in Southeast is in the southern portion. More of the little black specks are versus the northern portion.
Thanks.
Senate Finance on the record. Mr. Strauss, please continue.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. With that, would folks like me to move to the next slide?
Yes, please.
Okay, very good. So I'm just going to now briefly touch on the kind of the meat of the project development process. And I will be fairly swift going through this since it's I don't want it to be duplicative. Developing a carbon project really has a part of that same process. When Ms. Miller was describing how there are different ways that folks do this development, this model here, what you're seeing, would be consistent with what she was describing as the turnkey model, where folks move from where a developer would do really every portion of the project from the initial feasibility analysis all the way through to the full sale of the credits in the end. So in this kind of context, you really start with basically what we did in that pilot project analysis, where you're using existing data and information to kind of kick the tires on the project, understand what the potential is based on the rule sets. If you decide to move forward the project, it goes through a contracting phase, and then the project would be listed on the registry. Once that happens, that's sort of the line in the ground that is the official commencement of the project and the official commencement of the accumulation of carbon credits from the property. The next key piece, as I mentioned before, is there's a very important inventory that needs to take place, where a grid will be established across a given project area. Usually this is a grid that will try and have a what I would call an academic level of rigor in its analysis. So we're going to have a network of plots that has, you know, the statistical power to really make people feel comfortable making some pretty important assumptions about how much carbon is out there in the woods. And each one of the plots that are associated with that grid are permanent plots, meaning that they're going to be revisited on a regular basis, at least every 10 years over the 40 years of the project life. And on each of these plots, you're going to be collecting some pretty rich data sets, which would generally include the diameter of all the trees on the plots to the nearest tenth of an inch, the height of the trees to the nearest foot, identifying the species of all these trees, doing a subplot where you're measuring saplings, looking into dead trees, assessing the amount of damage on standing dead trees, as well as looking at carbon damage in the live canopy, et cetera, over generally a 10 to 15th acre space per plot. So the developer will design that and then go and have those plots actually collected out in the field, generally by local forestry experts. Then once that data is collected, then the carbon modeling and formal documentation is carried out. Ultimately, then once all those project docs are set, you can undergo your carbon verification. The verification, again, is the work that is done by that third-party accredited verifier that is expert in the methodologies as well as in the underlying science, and they will approve that both the measurements in the field and the calculations done in the spreadsheets and associated with the models are correct. Once they've approved the project, then the registry itself will do a final audit and vetting of their work and confirm that they are ready to issue and serialize these units, at which point the credits can be marketed and sold. And that happens on a repetitive basis on an annual, you know, for every year that you want to generate credits, you basically are going to go right back to the verification stage and repeat. So that'll happen for the 40-year life, under which you continue to quantify very clearly the amount of carbon as it accumulates on that landscape and monetize it in the marketplace. And I'll pause there.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, then this last slide, or the last real meat of the deck, is a Gantt chart kind of showing the timeline associated with one of these projects. I will not go through piece by piece by piece here, but suffice it to say that an efficient project, kind of at max efficiency, takes about 18 months to go from the listing stage where the project begins all the way through to that credit issuance stage where credits are issued and ready to be sold. It's not uncommon to see projects take about 24 months, and you know there's plenty of things that whether it be, you know, in an environment like Alaska, particularly where there are weather concerns and some serious challenges in terms of dealing with the elements, you can see a 24-month timeline. But 18 months is certainly something that is achievable. And it's, you know, as folks think this over, I like folks to keep that goal in mind as something that could be done if everything goes, you know, really smoothly. And with that, I will pause for more questions. I know that we're trying to move through this process expeditiously, so if that's all people need, I'll pause.
Thank you. This is Senator Merrick. I actually have a question about these carbon registries. You mentioned that they're nonprofit organizations. How are they funded?
So they receive a number of cents for every credit that's issued. So the idea being is, in the case of the American Carbon Registry, for every ton that is issued, they get approximately 17 cents. And so it's basically, that's what keeps the lights on.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And we have John Crowther, the Deputy Commissioner of DNR, with us. Any comments before we go to public testimony?
Thank you, Chair Merrick. No, nothing further this time.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Strauss, for your presentation. We appreciate it. And with that, we will open public testimony on Senate Bill 48, Carbon Offset Program on State Land. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will move to our legislative information offices. First in Homer, Mike Jones. Welcome to Senate Finance. Please place yourself on the record. Begin your two-minute testimony.
Hello, thank you. I am Mike Jones, resident of Homer, representing myself. I oppose SB 48. This process seems pretty sketchy. I'm concerned about the speed this legislation is being pushed through. The large number of amendments, versions, changes, and even questions being asked and answered in this morning's and afternoon sessions are all indicators that this is a rush, get-her-done approach to legislation that creates all kinds of opportunities for unintended consequences, manipulation, and people enriching themselves at our expense. For these and other reasons noted in my written testimony to be submitted later today, I oppose SB 48. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We appreciate you calling in. Next, we will go to online. It looks like in Palmer, we have Dave Maxwell. Welcome to Senate Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes.
Yeah, my name is Dave Maxwell. I live in Palmer. And I represent myself and my family as a grandfather as well. All this, is this carbon sequestration event that we have sitting before us, it looks to me like it's an effort to create a solution to a lie that's been perpetrated to us by the federal government. What's that lie? Global warming. So what does it look like here in the state, and what will be the ramifications? Let's just choose a little oil company that operates here in Alaska. They are being threatened and penalized for operating their field operations and dissipating carbon into the atmosphere. So they get penalized by the federal government, and they got two ways to pay that penalty. One is just cash. The other one is carbon sequestration. So apparently it's a little cheaper for them to go carbon sequestration. So what they do is they go to the government, say here in Alaska, and they say, we want to rent your land so that we can get out of this fine. So what happens then? The government of Alaska gets rich. Then what happens to the taxpayers? Well, that same outfit, that little oil company, now has to create a different revenue source. So they have to increase their commodities and their share of how they sell it. And so the taxpayer is the one who's the end user, and he ends up paying a higher rate to that penalized oil company. Government gets rich, the taxpayer gets screwed. So I would like to say, shame on our governor for not understanding this, And so I'm an absolute hard no on SB 48. Last statement, it's to no one's advantage other than the government. They're the ones that make out the citizens get screwed.
Great.
So please
say no. Thank you, Mr. Maxwell. We appreciate you taking the time to call in today. Next in Wasilla, Ken Griffin. Welcome to Senate Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Ken Griffin, calling on behalf of myself. I think it's important to note how this bill is being sold to the people under the pretense that these companies need and want this legislation so that, one, it can borrow money because finance is drying up for companies that aren't net zero. This is a falsity because these companies are already, as we saw in testimony today and other testimonies, companies have the ability to buy carbon credits now and engage in all this now. They don't require blanket legislation from the state, unvetted, to engage in this. They can literally go out and engage in carbon credits now. Net zero is a complete scam. It's a pay to play. We're not removing any CO2 in any way. And almost all the world projects that have tried this have showed that there's been an increase in CO2 in the areas because they're having trouble capturing their own emissions and the trees themselves as sink. What's important here is that the UN sustainable goals are what determine the value of these credits, not Vera and not Anew and all these companies, the gold standard. This is, they have adopted the UN sustainable goals. And those get reevaluated every 5 years, okay? That's a huge problem for us here in Alaska. Another aspect is what happens when the footprint of where these trees are and how many there are in one area decides all of a sudden that when the project gets reevaluated, they need more trees. And we can't meet that goal. How does that affect the value of the credits? This state is only 64 years old, and the bill is talking about locking these trees up for 55 years. How do we know that development won't get to those places? Anchorage is all basically full. A lot of this stuff's going to be moving out to the valley where we have a proposal for a 100,000-acre project locked up for 55, and Vera's even requested a 100-year lockup. What are we going to do? How are we going to untangle and unwind? And what are the liabilities of the evaluation of these credits, and will these companies be suing for all this stuff? Very important to know that, because in 55 years alone, we've made so much leaps and bounds in this state, and I hope that we continue to do so. I also think that there's a big question that you guys brought up today that's really important when it comes to the IRS.
Please wrap up your comments.
Okay. The IRS did not manage digital credits in the beginning. These carbon credits are digital credits, and I fully expect that the IRS and the SEC will come in and want to manage these credits later, just like they did cryptocurrency. I vote no, and I encourage you guys to put the brakes on this. It is not going to stop financing from any companies at this current moment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Griffin. We appreciate you calling in. Next from Anchorage, Cassie Andrews. Welcome to Senate Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your two-minute testimony.
Hello, members of the committee. Cassie Andrews from Anchorage, representing myself. I'm opposed to this legislation. The carbon trading market is an illusionary financial scam that will end up dragging our economy down into the greater rabbit hole of international carbon trading regimes and other ill-fated technocratic economic regimes. In the World Economic Forum's 8 predictions for the world, there will be a global price to carbon. We need to question adopting any policy that is in lockstep with the desires of unelected globalists. It is no coincidence that the most philosophically and ethically bent people are promoting this. Carbon monetization is an attempt to monetize our economic waste and place the burden directly on the people, not the corporations who or which have directed the use of carbon energy for the last several decades and have actually hindered progress towards other novel energy designs. That said, the burden will always come down on the regular people. Carbon monetization will lead to carbon taxes, and the creation of carbon markets where financial instruments and control features will be created and traded to modify behavior, which is a direct attack on personal sovereignty. This is happening right now in Australia, where carbon credits are being piloted for use with CBDCs. We cannot fix the cost of our civilization by quantifying every aspect of our lives. The only notion being served by carbon monetization is the false belief that it is for the collective good. The monetization of carbon in Alaska will only add another stranglehold to the prosperity of the middle class, as the creeping regressive nature of pricing carbon makes things simply more expensive. including your travel to work, your daily needs for food, it will all cost more. The fraud rate of this boondoggle is also one that warrants attention. VERA, a nonprofit incorporated in Colombia, World Economic Forum partner, invited by the House for testimony, VERA approves 3/4 of all voluntary carbon offset projects that have been found to be at over 90% fraud rate.
Please
Unfortunately, the will of the people and most of our elected officials tend not to comprehend economic or environmental issues to their full extent. And if they do, they tend to reflect popular opinions so as not to influence their election chances. However, popular globalist opinion on the environment tends to be hyper-overinflated. Please do not fall into the trap. Alaskans are counting on you to make the right decision. Thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you, Ms. Andrews. We appreciate you taking the time to call in. Next from Anchorage, Todd Lindy. Welcome to Senate Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. This is Todd Lindley. I'm calling in from Anchorage, and I'm representing myself and my family. I do not support this legislation. This is a Faustian bargain we need to avoid. Slide 18 of the DNR's presentation tells you everything you should know about what this program intends to do. And it states very clearly at the top, parties. The registry is a nonprofit that will provide quality control, ensure project and credit integrity. They set the rules. They will issue the credits, and they will track all of this. To be very clear, by voting on this to become law, all of you sitting in the room right now will be waiving your right, your legislative authority to the United Nations. So a few questions that you need to ask. Who are the registries? The first ones being the Gold Standard, VERA, and American Carbon Registry. We've heard from all of them, and we've heard examples of them and who they are funded by. The next question that you should ask is, how do they evaluate their carbon? Each one of these registries refers to their verification process back to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. So I'll leave you with this. Why would we allow the UN to govern Alaska resource policy? I hope that you all choose to make the right decision and to put this legislation to bed and never bring it back up, or it'll put us all into a state of slavery. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindley. We appreciate your time today. Next up from Wasilla, Ken Huckybaugh. Welcome to Senate Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your 2-minute testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Ken Huckabaugh from Wasilla. I represent myself, and I thank you for the opportunity. I would like to call back to some meetings a while back. A question was mockingly proffered by one of our legislators, and you can tell the derision in his voice during testimony that they asked the handpicked testifiers were WEF partners, and the question was absolutely dodged. Blue Source / TPGNU and VERA are indeed WEF partners, and you can go look on their website for yourselves. Don't take any our word for it. And so I just have to ask for the motivations. Who do we defer to on any of our decisions, on any of our policies? And why are they here, and what are they doing here? Why have we brought them here, and what's their motivations? I think the carbon capture and the whole carbon narrative is a self-generating thing, and you can see a whole industry built up around it. And it doesn't add anything to our production. It's a some negative that robs us and causes a huge inflationary index for the money that has been printed to start this. And I would like to say that the money printed so far for the aforementioned 90% fraud rate 45Q program has already started causing great inflation. And everybody goes to the grocery store, we can see the impact of these things. And it's going to get worse, because when that 45Q program, they're talking credits right now, is going to run out. They're not going to, they can't afford to print more money. Well, we'd like to think so. They're trying to cap that now on the federal government. But when that's gone, they will institute carbon taxes and fees on everything we do, eat, touch, move. And we're an energy and intensive state. And so it's going to cost Alaskans particularly a lot of money. And so when they do that, that's to come. That's even more inflation. It's going to cost us more. So, you know, we already established that this is from the WEF, and the people that are have been handpicked testimony are WEF partners. And so
thank you. Please wrap up your comments.
So I just ask you to abandon the setting this up and the state's participation in this Green New Bill and the WEF plans. And I wanted to ask if you had any questions of anybody that's testifying today. I'd offer any answers if you have anything to ask me. I'd like, do you know?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Huckabee. I don't see any questions from the committee, but we appreciate your time. Next up from Kenai is Ed Martin. Mr. Martin, welcome to Senate Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your two-minute testimony.
Yes, my name. Yes, my chairman, Merrick, and other members of the Senate Finance Committee. I'm a second generation prior to statehood. I could speak in length about what my dad's intentions were when he came to Alaska, the homestead federal land, and then subsequently got sort of screwed out of the mineral right because he fell into a period of time when he was supposed to prove up. This happened to many Alaskans. Our great resources at statehood were put in for common use. Article 8, Section 1 through 18, other than Section 15, spells out exactly what should be done with these resources. And I believe that this goes against the statement of policy right at the very beginning, to encourage the settlement of its land and the development of its resources by making them available for the maximum use. That is for us, Alaskans. As you go through Article 8, in each and every section, it pretty much spells out how our resources will be utilized and developed. And it goes toward the whole purpose of the whole state retaining those resources for our benefit, not for some polluting country or any nationalized corporation that continues to pollute around the world, of which we do very little. And yet we're going to suffer the brunt of the opportunity on our lands. This is absolutely out of control. For you to consider, and the governor to consider, selling up or locking out any of our resources whatsoever, because you haven't. You haven't conserved to the benefit of your policy for Alaska settlement and development.
Thank you. Please wrap up your comments.
Pardon me, ma'am?
Your 2 minutes is over. Can you please wrap up your comments?
Yes, I implore you folks, you're on the cutting edge of this, and if you think that you're going to gain any revenue to the state by these means, you're absolutely wrong thought toward what is a benefit to the people of Alaska. Please stop this now. I am deadly against this. As far as I'm concerned, it's got to stop.
Thank you very much, Mr. Martin. We appreciate you calling in. Next in Wasilla, Lydia Shoemaker, welcome to Senate Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your two-minute testimony.
Hi, my name is Lydia Shoemaker. I live in Wasilla, and I'm calling in for myself. I would like to oppose SB 48, and I firstly want to point out that there's a massive difference between a Native corporation and the state of Alaska. The fact that this bill has reached your committee with blank or largely presumptive fiscal notes that have been manipulated each step of the way to mitigate concerns is embarrassing. Although this bill is presented to you as easy money, there is no such thing. In previous hearings, we have never heard actual costs or revenue, and this legislation leaves a massive loophole for the rights of Alaskans to be sacrificed through regulation. I would like to ask this committee to dig further into the baseline and additionality. It was presented to you today, and it is a very complex issue. Having watched all of the other hearings, I would like to point out a couple things. It has been previously stated that this is determined by a third party, meaning the baseline and additionality, and it will be impacted as soon as any new forestry plan is implemented into law. And it will affect the potential harvest patterns. Now, Alaska's only been in the state for just over 60 years, and we're looking at locking up our trees simply because we aren't doing anything with them right now for a very long time. And a lot can happen and change. Hopefully we grow as a state. And so I just want to point out that when they're referring to harvesting trees, it has been stated in a previous hearing that if you are to harvest trees in an area that they deem worthy of this program, you can no longer just say, okay, well, if we're 10 acres are locked up in this program, we'll go harvest 10 acres somewhere else. And there's never been an opportunity cost presented for any of this. So not only do we not know the revenues, we don't know the cost, and we don't know the opportunity cost that we could potentially be losing either. And somehow this made it to your guys' desk. I do ask that you oppose this legislation and dig deep into it, because there is a lot going on here. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Shoemaker. We appreciate you calling in today. Is there anyone else online or in the room wishing to testify on Senate Bill 48? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. I'd like to thank Mr. Crowther for being here and the Department of Natural Resources for presenting today. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, that concludes this afternoon's agenda. Tomorrow, Tuesday morning, will likely be canceled because we are hearing the joint session. And then tomorrow afternoon, we'll be hearing Senate Bill 138, Elections, Voter Registration by the Senate State Affairs Committee. With nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 3:26 p.m. Thank you.